By listening to the Conscious Fertility Podcast, you agree to not use this podcast as medical advice to treat any medical condition in either yourself or others. Consult your own physician or healthcare provider for any medical issues that you may be having. This entire disclaimer also applies to any guests or contributors to the podcast. Welcome to Conscious Fertility, the show that listens to all of your fertility questions so that you can move from fear and suffering to peace of mind and joy. My name is Lauren Brown. I'm a doctor of traditional Chinese medicine and a clinical hypnotherapist. I'm on a mission to explore all the paths to peak fertility and joyful living. It's time to learn how to be and receive so that you can create life on purpose. Today on the Conscious Fertility Podcast, I'm joined by Dr. Paul Dieppe, a British physician and professor who spent much of his career in conventional medicine before turning his focus to healing in all its forms, physical, emotional, and spiritual. Dr. Dieppe is a former rheumatologist and academic at the University of Exeter and Bristol, and he's the co-author of Healing and Medicine, A Doctor's Journey Toward Their Integration. In our conversation today, we're going to explore how his personal experience and research led him to believe that true healing goes beyond conventional medicine and how we can begin to bring those worlds together. Paul, welcome to the Conscious Fertility Podcast.
Thank you.
Now, you're a physician, medical doctor, rheumatologist, you've taught in medicine. I think it's fair to begin with your story, because how does somebody go from that profession to, when I've been learning about you, gone into really the world of healing where maybe your peers have think you've lost your mind? So there must be some personal experiences where you've had this transformation, if you're willing to share with our audience.
Yes, of course. It's a complicated story. I had a healing experience when I was a boy before I started at medical school. And I went into medicine thinking that it would be about caring and healing. And it wasn't. It was about being a body mechanic, like a car mechanic. And I was sort of disillusioned by that. But I found that, without wanting to sound too pleased with myself, I was quite good at it. And it came easily, the being a body mechanic. And I got caught up by the whole business of medicine, which of course is huge, and allowed myself to be seduced by it. And of course, medicine does a lot of good for a lot of people. So one shouldn't really apologize for that. But I became seduced completely by the ethos of medicine, by its story about itself, by the research. And I was successful in that. And I sort of forgot about my earlier life experience and my wish to have gone into a caring profession rather than science. And I got on with it and I enjoyed it. And it was all going fine until when I was 44. I was taken hostage in Iraq and Kuwait. And I had some strange experiences there, which kind of rekindled my old interest in not only healing and caring, but in paranormal events, which I've been interested in again since a young man. And when I got back into my career, I found I was no longer excited by it. I was no longer convinced that this was the right way forward, or the only way forward, I should say. So rather gradually, through a difficult period of transition and getting over PTSD and the rest, I gradually changed my focus to caring and healing. So that, in short, is it.
And if we can unpack a little bit of that, I have some curious questions. You said as a boy you had an experience. Later, when you went to medicine, you wanted to go into the healing and caring, and you got caught up into the science of it, the mechanics. Interesting, in Chinese medicine, we see ourselves as gardeners. So, you know, you're the body mechanic trying to fix all the different parts. And in Chinese medicine, and I guess in many healing traditions, the body's seen as an ecosystem. And you're creating a healthy environment by pulling weeds, nourishing the soil, adding water, knowing that the organism, in this case, the plant or the body, will take what it needs to do its healing. So it's interesting that you saw that you were playing like a body mechanic versus a gardener.
Yes, absolutely.
And to highlight, you said, don't apologize for medicine. I want to hear just about your boyhood experience And did you have a paranormal experience while you were as a hostage? You mentioned you had some PTSD afterwards, but I'm curious, were there any non-ordinary states that you had as a child or during that hostage that started to shift who you are today?
Well, sure. Well, let's start with the childhood one. So, sport was very important to me as a child, and I was okay at that. And we have a strange game in this country called rugby union, which is sort of our equivalent to your American football. It's a very physical game, a very tough game. And when I was playing that at school, I got a severe kidney injury, and which destroyed one of my kidneys. I was taken into hospital. I was told I'd probably need the kidney taken out the following day, and I guess I was quite ill. I'd lost a lot of blood internally. The strange experience was the following day when the team came around to see me, preparing to take me to an operating theatre to take my kidney out. And I was not well. I was in a lot of pain. I was a bit shivery and all the rest. But I was a naive 16-year-old boy. I didn't know what was going on. And this team came up to my bedside and asked me how I was. And something completely extraordinary happened at that moment. I suddenly knew that I was fine and everything was fine with the world. They were looking worried, and I knew they needn't be worried. I knew it was all fine. And my pain went, and I sat up in bed and I told them, "Yeah, I'm fine, thanks. I feel great," which caused a bit of consternation amongst the medical team. And they asked me a few questions and they prodded me a bit and the rest. And I was just in this extraordinary euphoric state. It was almost an out-of-body experience. I was almost looking down on the whole thing, wishing that they'd stop worrying about me, really. And they did after a bit, and they said, "Well, okay, well, we won't operate today. We'll see how he does, and we'll have another think about it tomorrow." And they went away, and pretty much straight after that, I was slumping back in bed and I was in pain. But it was a most extraordinary experience, the sort of thing that's sometimes called a noetic experience. It was pretty much an out-of-body thing. I never had the operation and I got better. I still only have one kidney, of course, but that's fine.
Interesting. So you had a glimpse of that experience, that non-ordinary state. So that got
Yes, but there's a caveat to it as well that I'll share with you, that I didn't know this, but at the time that was going on, I heard later that my parents had organized a prayer meeting for me, which was going on. And they told me that they were sure that I'd been healed as a result of God's intervention and their prayer meeting. That's a pretty hard thing to hear as a 16-year-old. And I found that very difficult indeed.
to hear that they were praying for you.
Yeah, well, I was okay about the fact that they were praying for me. I found the concept that God would want to intervene in my puny little life, well, a pretty strange concept. And I had a lot of trouble believing in God anyway, and still do.
Do you have a sense now, many years later, what that experience was? Like, just so you know, our audience, we've had quantum physicists on here. They talk about
Yeah.
Newtonian, so they're comfortable for you to get what we use the word weird. It's only weird because it goes against conventional, but feel free to share what, if you want, what you think was happening then as a 6-year-old.
Well, I think it was one of these noetic experiences. I suppose my current kind of explanation for it, because although I'm happy with weird as well, and I'm happy with quantum weirdness, although I don't understand it, I'm happy with all that. But nevertheless, I can't stop myself wanting an explanation. And rather than it being an intervention by a god, my explanation would be that the good will and the conscious effort to allow me to heal by a group of people probably helped facilitate this strange experience and strange event. So that would be my current way of processing what happens to me.
And you've had other noetic experiences. I remember learning about one regarding your father, if you're willing to share. I want to kind of set up what you've had these glimpses or experiences that have led you to do what you're doing today. So you know what I'm talking about with that non-ordinary, I call them non-ordinary states or noetic experiences.
I was a hostage in Kuwait and Iraq for some 5 months with a group of other men. It's a strange story. We were taken off an airplane that was refueling as Iraq invaded Kuwait. And I spent quite a lot of time in a small two-bedroom flat with seven other men. Conditions were bad. We weren't fed well. We weren't allowed out. Things were pretty grim. But the flat had been owned by a university professor of Kuwait University. So there were good things there, like some books and some papers and pencils. And I and some of the others used the paper and pencils to try and keep a diary of what was going on, and sort of became a ritual that I'd write a paragraph or two of my diary each morning. But I was doing that one morning, about 6 or 7 weeks into this difficult period, and I suddenly had an overwhelming feeling of sadness and loss that was huge and overwhelming, and so much so that I stopped writing kind of mid-sentence. And I had a feeling that it was something to do with my father, but I couldn't understand what it was. But it was very, very distressing. And I never picked up that diary again. So I know exactly when this happened, because I had been keeping date and time in the diary. And it was only as I was coming home some 3 to 4 months later that I learned that was the day that my father had died. I didn't know he'd even been ill, and he died on that day. That's what in the literature is called, as I'm sure you know, a shared death experience, that my father was reaching out to me as he was dying. And that was another very profound experience and was part of my reawakening, I guess.
Yeah, and the key word is reawakening. They do say suffering can lead to awakening, and it must have been challenging for your trained mind as a conventional physician, because this is kind of outside that box, especially back then. Was this start of that process, that there's more to this world than we can measure on the materialistic level? Did you start to, or did you shut it down right away?
I'm not sure I completely know the answer to that question. I shut it down to begin with, because it was too difficult. And, you know, I had a lot of things to deal with. My family were very traumatized by the whole event. My father had died. I had a lot to try and process and deal with when I got back home, and I didn't dwell on that moment. But what I did do as I slowly got better was I started reading about such things. I didn't know the concept of a shared death experience when this happened to me. I didn't know anything about near-death experiences. I didn't know this stuff existed. And I started reading, and I learned that actually, yeah, this thing happens to not a lot of people, but a number of people, where particularly shared death experiences are probably a lot commoner than we think, because most people won't admit to them. So that helped me in the sense that, well, I'm not mad. Other people have this experience. It wasn't complete madness. Similarly, with some other experiences I have there. So slowly, I started to understand that I had been privileged, and I use that word deliberately. I've been privileged to experience some of these other types of phenomena that occur in our world that are not easily explained by our Newtonian physics understanding of the world. And of course, all of my medical profession is entirely based on materialistic thinking, based on Newtonian physics alone. So I had to start slowly to rethink where I was and what I was doing.
What kind of work or research did you do in near-death experience? And I want to get into the medical placebo. And you said something about, like, you know, the conventional medicine is still the Newtonian physics, and we have a whole new physics, quantum physics. And I often think of it as like what it must have been like in the day of the scientists when they thought the sun rotated around the earth, and they're saying, no, no, actually the earth goes around the sun. The earth is spinning and we're round, not flat. And the scientists that were ruling the nest were like, look in the sky, you can see the sun move. Look out, you can see how the, you know, making them look like they were crazy, you know, and there's this whole new science trying to emerge. I feel like when we talk about consciousness and the stories you're sharing, your peers, our modern day scientists, are like, one of their weapons is to shame you, right? Like, look at this, it's ridiculous. Look at all the evidence we can show you that it doesn't make sense. I'm curious though, because change happens from, part of that aspect is those that are ruling the nest or have a monopoly on medicine. It's those people that have to change the rules. So what did you learn from, and did you do work in NDEs? And I'd like to talk about placebo as well, because that's usually the word they throw around when somebody sees somebody who's not a conventional medical doctor.
Yes, well, there's a lot of things in what you just said, Leonard. So first of all, I agree with you totally. We need a paradigm shift, to use another phrase. And I think the paradigm shift that is needed is to understand, which many quantum physicists have been saying for a very long time, that consciousness is a fundamental property and not something that's generated by our brains. And medicine, conventional medicine, clings very tightly to this idea that somehow the neuronal circuits in our brain generate consciousness. I think the evidence against that is absolutely overwhelming, but they still cling to it. But I believe things are changing. I'm actually quite optimistic that the paradigm shift of that understanding will occur moderately soon, and that'll change everything, and that'll be akin to your analogy of realizing that the earth goes around the sun rather than the other way around. It's similarly big. And I think things like near-death experiences, shared-death experiences are reasons, of course, for knowing, those of us who've been lucky enough to experience them, knowing that consciousness is not isolated to our brains. So what did I do? Well, I've not done research directly myself on any of these death-related phenomena. I've simply read other people's research and books. Well, I suppose that's a form of research, secondary research. I've not done any primary research on those phenomena that I experienced, but I've read quite a lot of the literature.
What is your take or explanation of placebo? We had a conversation with Bill Bankston. I don't know if you know Bill Bankston.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I know his writing, yeah.
Yeah. So, and just to our listeners, because he's recent, he just passed last month at the time of our recording. So he passed in April or early May 2025. So heartfelt out to his family and to Bill. But placebo, can you kind of define what we're calling placebo in the West? And then from your literature's review and the work that you've done, do you have an understanding, not from the Newtonian level, but from the quantum level of what could be happening?
Okay. So, I have done some primary research on, as well as secondary research. And perhaps for me, more intriguingly, what's called placebo's evil twin, nocebo, the phenomenon of getting much worse as a result of being given no intervention.
Apologize to interrupt. You said nocebo? Our listeners that are looking to grow their families, often they're told by their doctor, when they're women have shared with me, when they're younger, you have a condition, PCOS, you're not going to get pregnant, it's going to be hard to get pregnant. Or they come and they're 40 and they say you can't get pregnant because of the age. So a lot of women come in and they're not aware of, but when the doctors are trying to give them statistics on their chances so they can decide whether to follow treatment or spend money, a lot of the things that they hear is you can't get pregnant. And because the doctor has a nice white coat, it has a big impression on them and they can take that on as a truth versus a opinion. So I just wanted to share, because maybe you can tie that in when you talk about nocebo.
No, I understand what I was just saying fits in with that, but I think doctors are incredibly good at inducing nocebo effects. So I have done quite a lot of research on placebo and nocebo, and as a result of which I don't understand them. So they're powerful, big effects, and as you were saying, often much, much bigger than any standard treatment. So one of my particular interest in medicine has been osteoarthritis. And the problem with for most people with that condition is pain. And placebos are a lot better at treating the pain than any other intervention we give. So all the drugs and so on are outperformed by a placebo, which is very interesting. So what is happening with placebo, I don't know. I think the medical profession has got itself into a terrible muddle here by confusing how and why. So we know quite a lot about how, but that isn't the same as why. So the how we can sort of explain with our clever toys like fMRI scanners, functional MRI scanners and the rest. And we can see changes occurring in the brain and in the neural pathways that control pain. And we can say, ah, well, that's what's happening. That's it. Well, that's how, but it's not why. And I don't know why placebo and nocebo effects are so powerful. But I think it's akin to healing. So I think that it's part of these sets of phenomena that are not explicable with our classical disease-centered approach to understanding the body and mind. And how much of healing is placebo and vice versa doesn't matter to me at all, because as long as we learn how to use these effects to the benefit and we can learn how not to induce nocebo effects, that's fine. I don't mind that I don't understand it.
Have you seen a pattern of what can help induce placebo? And maybe we can define the Western, what they're calling a placebo in Western terms. And then I'm curious if you found there's ways to elicit that innate healing in the body.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, first of all, your first question about how we think of it and define it within the Western model. So that's become dominated by the thinking around trials. So particularly drug trials where you test whether or not a drug is helpful for a particular condition. And the classical way of doing that is to make up a dummy tablet with nothing in it but looks exactly the same as the real medicine. Presuming this is tablets, of course, it's more difficult, as you say, with things like acupuncture, but there are various ways around those things. But so you have a dummy pill, looks exactly the same as the real pill, and you compare the two, and you only think that your new drug works if it does better than the dummy tablet. The problem is that the dummy tablet generally does extremely well. Now, that's the placebo effect. And traditional trialists hate it and have tried to dismiss it as nonsense, but they failed to do that. It's real. So that's what we call the placebo response in conventional medicine. That was your first question, and I have now forgotten what your second one was.
What are ways to support? We've given it a bad name, placebo, like, oh, like, you know, yes. Let's take it away. We want just the drug to be doing it. And
yes.
Again, from my background, the training that I have is we have this understanding that the body has an innate ability to heal, and we want to support and engage that healing. And so that's where, you know, like Western medicine doesn't think it does it, but ritual, you know, the doctor puts up his hand, he washes it. Somebody else has to put on his gloves. There's big lights and, you know, that's all part of ritual. I think that has a bit of a placebo effect, if I pick in the ritual behind it. What do you learn in your research that can support that innate healing, which we're calling the placebo impact?
Yeah, no, I completely agree about ritual. I think the ritual is important, and I think having a vehicle is important. So you need something in addition to yourself. You need to be able to give something to have some form of intervention and the ritual around that. But I think the more important component is compassionate caring alongside the administration of the ritual or the medicine or the whatever, or the acupuncture or whatever it is, doesn't matter. I think it's compassionate caring. I use the word compassion deliberately A lot of people talk about empathy, but I think that's dangerous for reasons we could discuss, but probably won't, because it's a rather arcane argument. But I think compassion is the key. Compassionate caring about the other person.
I'm going to go with the compassion and empathy. I'm going to pull that card because I'm curious your thought on that. You brought it up, and a thought came through me pretty quickly. In my practice, my intention is to have compassion, not empathy.
Yes.
And to not sound like cruel to our listeners, just as how my experience is, and people are hearing, not seeing this, but I'm doing a visual with you. You know, if we have somebody running at a level 7, the practitioner and the person who's suffering is at a level 4, empathy would be me going down to meet them at level 4. So now we're both at a low vibration. That doesn't serve anybody. I want to stay at a level 7 and bring them up to level 7. So that's what compassion is. Not dismissing how they feel, understanding, letting them know I get how they feel, but without me needing to go down to where they're at to raise them up, is to stay at a level to bring them up. That's my best way to explain it.
I'm very excited because I totally 100% agree with that. And most people just don't get it. And we continue to teach in medical schools about the need for empathy. But empathy is very dangerous because, as you say, you go down to the level of the patient. When I came back from my bad experience in Iraq, I was finding it very difficult to be with my patients in the way I had before. And I realized after a while I was being too empathic. I had become empathic in a way that was damaging to me and, I think, to them. So I learned the hard way about this lesson. I think you need a compassionate carer and an empathic caree. So the person who's been careful can be empathic, because then they can come up to your level 7 with you rather than you both going down to your level 4.
And in some of the literature I've read, my understanding is kind of like when there's a healing happening between the healee and the healer in some of these studies, like you talked about the fMRIs, they see kind of like there's a change in the brain, a parasympathetic link up. It's kind of unconscious that the healing happens. And so when somebody's suffering, my intention is through breath work and other things to keep me in a nice, calm, parasympathetic state, because I feel like I'm Wi-Fi. And if I get into their story too much and I go into sympathetic, then we're amplifying that suffering, that stress. This is just how I think about it, because my left brain needs to understand things.
Again, I totally agree. Can I tell you a short story?
Please.
I like telling stories. So when I started my sort of changed career, started to work on healing and associated phenomena academically, I linked in with a wonderful colleague who is a drama teacher. And she thought that drama might help us teach medical students about communication. So I was a bit skeptical, but she said, well, tell you what, come to join me and one of my colleagues and we'll do a workshop to show you the sort of thing we can do. So I was sort of a bit nervous about this, you know, drama, people doing a workshop. I'm a doctor, what's going on? Anyway, I went along and there were these two quite senior drama academics, and they had arranged a huge room in the drama department, and we went in there and I sat down and got out my iPad as usual to check my emails, and they started doing a whole of strange breathing exercises, and they started doing odd movements like they were sort of warming up for the 800 meters or something, and they were moving around in odd ways and stopping and breathing. And they did this for about 10 minutes or something while I checked my emails. And then they stopped and said, we're ready now. And I said, well, what were you doing? And they said, well, we were just preparing ourselves. And one of them said to me, so what do you do before you see a patient to prepare yourself? And that hit me like a blow in the guts, because like most doctors up until that point, I did nothing. I may again have checked my emails or eaten a sandwich before I called the patient in, but I had not prepared myself and my state of mind in order to be able to be the compassionate companion that the patients needed. And that single event changed my practice and hopefully changed it for the better.
And it sounds like you become present before you see your patient.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah.
So I've heard you say healing and love as well. So I kind of want to talk about this, but I want to give you something you said that I want to tie it in that I think where I get optimistic for my patients, and it ties into being present when you see your patients. And it comes from Gordon Neufeld's work. He's a local psychologist in my city of Vancouver. He's written a book, and he's big on attachment theory. And he says every human being wants the same thing, to be seen and heard. And when people feel seen and heard, it equals love, he said. So when you shared about, you know, warming up and before you see your patient, and when you're in the patient, again, holding compassion for them, right? Not dismissing them. And I'm just curious from your work, and you've used the word love and healing, and then what I just shared with you from how I kind of tied in Neufeld's work, if you feel seen and heard, you feel loved. And you can do this for yourself. You know, there's inner work. When you do inner work, you are seeing and hearing that part of yourself. So to me, that's why people can do their own healing. But I'm curious from what I just shared, and then all the stuff that you have worked with and you have shared, I've heard you share, love and healing. Can you elaborate on that, please? Is that not too big of an ask?
Well, that's a simple little question, isn't it? But I have to say, I'm honored to be on a same podcast as people like Dean Radin and Bill Bankston, and all whose works I'm familiar with and hold in great respect. So I'm going to answer that question. It was a bit more than a question, really, in a slightly strange way, I think. Love, yes. And I have sort of concluded that a way of thinking about healing is love in action. But that begs the question to our analytical minds of what is love. And it also begs the question of what is healing. And I don't think we have any satisfactory answer to either of those questions. I don't know what healing is. I don't know what love is, because they are not things that you can break down, dissect, analyze, define. They defy language. They defy our understanding. I mean, all popular songs are about love and the many different forms of love. I have many different experiences of love. My love for my children is different from my love for my football team. But I love the football team as well as my children, but it's a different form of love. And because it's experiential, it's an experience within ourselves. It's not a thing. And I think healing's exactly the same. And I think healing and love probably are linked, but I don't know what either of them are. And what I do know is that they can both take many, many different forms within our world and within our experience of it and our being. So that's a convoluted answer to your challenge.
I appreciate that. It's one of those things where when you're having that experience yourself, it's a feeling. It's an experience.
Yes, it's a feeling. Yeah, it's not a thing.
Yeah, and it's hard to put a label on it. Like,
yeah,
they're calling it love. It's the best word we have, but again,
yes,
pretty can be vague. Let's go into kind of like your book and just this integration. I want to kind of tie that part together here with our time. And again, I'm really enjoying our conversation. I love your stories, by the way. So, does medicine need healing itself? And what do you see, or what would you hope for a medical system? So I see massive transformation in these 25 years where we've gone from two types of modalities being practiced parallel to each other, not communicating to each other, and patient not sharing that they're seeing other people, to both know they're seeing both and often will be communicating, to where I see people like you trained in both. So I'm pretty optimistic of what I call integration. So I'm curious, what do you see as the present and future of medicine?
So I'm actually less optimistic about the change than you are. I've not seen much change in attitudes in my 50 years in medicine. Don't remind me of my age all the time. I think if anything, it's worse. now than it was when I trained, in terms of the attitude of the hierarchy of medicine. And maybe the difference is between those who are in charge, as it were, of medicine, the big cheeses in medicine, and the practicing Joe on the ground. But the big cheeses are desperately, in my experience and in this country, desperately anti almost any alternatives. And I had a lot of trouble, and I still do, from colleagues when I tell them I'm interested in healing and I think it can go alongside conventional medicine, conventional Western medicine. I don't see it getting better, at least in Great Britain. Although there are a lot of individual practitioners who are open to integration, I don't think the body politic is open to integration. And actually, I don't think it's open to integration in your country either, from my limited experience. So I'm not that optimistic in that sense, unless we have this shift of understanding of consciousness, which will change everything, which I hope we might. So as far as bringing the two together, I think it's got to be bottom up, not top down. I'm not optimistic about those in charge of medicine being able to cope with the idea of integration and healing. And part of the reason, I think, is money. I think medicine's been ruined by becoming so commercialized. Now, this is a hell of a lot worse in America than it is in England, but it's pretty bad everywhere. And the drug companies and the device companies are completely in charge. They're in charge of policy. They're in charge of research. They're in charge of everything. They don't want alternatives because that might mean we stop taking their tablets and using alternatives instead. So I think that's a huge barrier. Well, that's very difficult to break down. So I think it's got to be bottom up. So it's got to be from people like you and me, and it's got to be from people going to their doctors saying, no, I want to mix and match. Thanks very much. Why don't you know about acupuncture? Why don't you know about homeopathy? They work. What's going on here? Why aren't you taught about that? I'm all for a bottom-up movement rather than a top-down one.
That usually moves things anyhow. Because when the public wants it, they change. From the reproductive fertility world that I've been my focus, that's how, like, pretty much most IVF clinics have acupuncturists that go on site for our IVF transfer days. And right. That wasn't because the doctors wanted it. The public kept on demanding it. And it became a competitive thing that if you didn't have acupuncturists or work with an acupuncturist, the patient would find a clinic that did it. So you've trained in energy healing. So you've experienced it. What was your first experience of energy healing with your knee? Was that your experience?
Yes.
You mind sharing that? Because I have some questions around
hearing
that
another story.
And I love the part after, please bring that, because your daughter's a physician, right?
Yes.
I just can imagine. But if you could share the story, you like telling stories, and our audience really loves to hear these stories. So introduce us to your knee story. I think you've worked with horses too. I love your story. So if you're willing to share, please do.
Okay. Well, the background briefly is that I was an academic rheumatologist for the first half of my career, and I had a special interest in osteoarthritis, which is one of the most boring diseases in the world, but very common and a big problem. And I remain quite interested in it. And I thought I knew a lot about it. When I was starting to research healing, I started getting real problems with osteoarthritis of one of my knees. It was really quite painful and quite difficult. And, you know, I didn't think it was supposed to be that bad or that difficult. But, you know, I was experiencing it in a completely different way as a patient, as it were, rather than a doctor. And I realized I didn't really understand it. And I didn't know what to do about it. And I went to one of my trusted orthopedic colleagues and said to him, look, I've got a bad knee. Can you have a look at it and see what you think? And he had a look at it and he x-rayed it. And he said, oh, it's a terribly bad osteoarthritic knee, Paul. You need it replaced. I tell you what, I could probably fit you in next week if you like. And I thought, blimey, this is a bit quick and a bit sudden, and do I really want to do that? And I said to him, well, thanks very much. I'm actually a bit busy next week. Can I come back to you? And he said, sure, just let me know when you're ready and I'll do it for you. And I went on my way. Try and get the sequencing right here. Just before I saw this surgeon, I'd been to stay with my doctor daughter, and I couldn't get up and down her stairs at her home. And she'd said to me, oh, for goodness sake, go and get your knee replaced, you fool. You don't want to be stumbling around like that in pain. And, you know, she'd say, get it replaced. The surgeon said, get it replaced. And I was thinking, well, maybe I should get it replaced. But then the following week, one of my assignments was to interview a healer in her own home in the west of England, who I'd been given a contact with and said she was happy to be interviewed. This was a fairly, how shall I put it, mature lady who'd seen a lot of life and who'd only taken up healing later in her life. And she was delightful. She ushered me into her home. She gave me a cup of coffee. She sat me down on my recording machine ready for the formal interview, switched it on, and she looked at me. She said, you know, the only way you can really understand healing is to experience it. Have you got anything wrong with you that I could have a go at? And I said, well, I have got this bad knee. And she said, oh, yeah, okay, well, I'm happy to take on a knee. I said, roll your trousers up and we'll get on with it and we'll try healing. So there I was sitting in the front room of an elderly lady who I didn't know, rolling my trousers up, with my recorder humming away in the background. And I was thinking, this is just crazy. What am I doing? Anyway, I went with it. She'd put her hands on my knee, and the next bit's hard to explain, but she disappeared from the room. She left it. She didn't leave it physically. She was still there. Her hands were on my knee, but somehow she wasn't present. She wasn't there. In a strange way. I don't know how else to explain this.
Physically there, or she physically really did leave?
No, she was visibly there. She was physically there. I could feel her hands on my knee, but her essence was not there. If you like, her soul was not there. And I was very aware of the fact that part of her was not in the room. And this went on for a while, and my knee felt very strange. And hot and weird, and I was dealing with skepticism and disbelief, so I was a jumble of what is going on here, what am I doing? But I didn't disturb the process. After a while, she came back to the room, she took her hands off my knee, and she looked completely drained, and she said, well, it is a very bad knee. I've made some progress, but I can't get it completely better. But I've made some progress. And I didn't know what to make of this. And I thought I knew about osteoarthritis, and I thought, you know, this is just silly. But my knee had felt very strange. And after I left her, it did feel a bit better. And over the next few days, it got a lot better. And I didn't go back to the surgeon because my knee was pretty good. And I went to see my daughter a couple of weeks later again, same house. Got up the stairs, no difficulty. She didn't notice. We decided to go out for a drink that evening together. Went out for a drink. We walked briskly across a park to get to a pub, a local pub that she fancied taking me to. And she suddenly looked around and she said, you're walking properly again. You snuck off and had your knee replaced without telling me, didn't you? And, you know, she's a skeptical young lady and trained in modern medicine. And I looked at her and I said, no, Claire, no, I haven't had it replaced. I had it healed. And she's got a look. And she looked at me as if to say, I know my father has completely lost it. I know now that he's gone mad. And she gave me that look, and then she stopped herself and she said, you're serious, aren't you? I said, yes. I went to a healer, and it's better as a result of that. And she said to me, so have you had it re-x-rayed to see if the x-rays got better? And I said, no, I'm not interested in the x-ray. I'm just pleased that the pain's gone. And her response was, if you have it re-x-rayed and the x-ray shows that the osteoarthritis has gone away, we're all finished, aren't we? She actually used a nastier word than that. But what she was trying to say was that medicine would be completely undermined by that. And I sort of had to agree with her. And that's the story. I've never had my knee replaced. It troubles me a little every now and then. I did have another x-ray a few years ago when it flared up a bit, and it's not nearly as bad as it was on the most recent x-ray.
There's more to this world than that's taught in medical school, I guess, is what you learned.
I don't think my daughter accepts that.
She just accepts it. And you've gone on to train in energy healing. So you're trained and you do energy healing. And have you seen experiences with the people you worked on to see a shift in physical, spiritual, emotional?
I don't actually practice it. I have trained in it. I have been told by the trainers that I'm a powerful healer potentially. But I don't do it. I don't practice it. I mean, I can give you other excuses of why I don't do it, but I think they're probably excuses. But I don't see patients anymore. I've retired. You know, I'm 78. I don't know medicine anymore. I haven't kept up with the field. So integration would be tricky for me because I don't know my old side of it. So I've got lots of excuses lined up, but they're excuses of all.
So. The last part I wanted to ask you is for my own curiosity, and I want to be sensitive because you talked about when you were taken as a hostage and you had PTSD, and talking about these things, you know, for somebody's experienced it, I don't know how you re-experience it or we talk about it. So if you're not comfortable talking about it, please don't. I'm curious about the experience you had when I think you thought you were going to be executed, because it sounded like a beautiful experience that you had. And so it's a little confusing for me. And I just wondering if you know what I'm talking about and can share a bit about that.
Yes, absolutely. I'm quite happy talking about that. And it was a beautiful experience. So this was right on day one. So what happened was I was going to Malaysia to do some teaching with an ex-trainee of mine who'd set up rheumatology in Malaysia, and she'd asked me out there to do some lecturing and teaching of her trainees. I got on a flight that was bound for Kuala Lumpur, not knowing that it was going to refuel in Kuwait. And it refueled in Kuwait as Iraq invaded Kuwait. And we were everyone was bundled off the plane very quickly into the terminal building. And we had the strange experience of watching the runway we'd arrived on being bombed to bits, which kind of made you realize that probably we wouldn't be moving on immediately. And that was all very surreal. And then after several hours, it's in the middle of the night, we were told that we were going to be put in buses and taken to the airport hotel to get some rest and refreshment, and not to worry, everything would be fine. Just need a few days to get this sorted out and we'll get you back home or where you want to go. All very reassuring. So we get into buses to drive across the tarmac of Kuwait Airport to the airport hotel. I was sort of at the typical airport bus with big doors on the side. I was crammed up next to one of the doors and with a lot of other people. And we were driving across the tarmac and some soldiers rushed up to the bus and stopped it. The doors were opened, and there were a couple of young men carrying Kalashnikovs pointing at them at us, and we said they cried out, "Passports, passports!" And I didn't know where my passport was, but I had my boarding pass, the pass that I've been given when I got off the plane, so say, to get me back on again. So I gave them that, and they spat on it and threw it on the ground and hustled me out of the bus with about, I think, five others who couldn't immediately lay a hand on the passport. And they marched us across the tarmac into an open space, lined us up next to each other, and then raised their Kalashnikovs, pointing them at us. Someone next to me said, "Oh my God, they're going to shoot us." And indeed, it did seem that that was what was going to happen. As I realized that I was probably going to be shot, I had the most wonderful experience of beauty and love and light and all being well with the universe. And I was not the slightest bit anxious about being shot because I knew everything was absolutely fine, and it was a beautiful experience. And I've no idea how long it lasted. I was sort of aware of the fact that some other soldier rushed up and made the boys put their Kalashnikovs down. We got back on the bus and got to the airport hotel. And this was another life-changing moment. It was beautiful. It was wonderful. Yeah. And I parked it for a long time because what do you do with an experience like that? I was a 44-year-old successful medical scientist, and what do I do with something like that? I didn't know what to do with it, and I didn't talk about it or share it for a long time. So that's the experience.
Thank you for sharing that. And yeah, I just, it's the beautiful part of it, and why I wanted to share it, and again, I wanted to hear the story to understand it better, is just there's more to this world than we think. And if we can learn to tune into that aspect, maybe more peace within. And then if the external world is a reflection of our internal world, we'll see more peace in the external world. I get the sense from you that healing is what we call love in action. It's hard to describe what love is in action. But one of the messages that I really resonate with your work is, in your writing, it's not what you do, but it's the way you do it. And that's one of my big takeaways from your works and things that you've shared. So I want to thank you for that. Do you have anything? I want them to know how they can connect with you. I'll mention your book again is Healing in Medicine, A Doctor's Journey Toward Integration. Anything you want to share with our audience before we wrap up today?
Well, I'd like to thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation as well. The only other thing I would like to just add to, for balance, as it were, and I think it's appropriate balance, is that we mustn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. The modern Western medicine is extremely good at a lot of things. So it's integration we need. It's not either or. I think you said that earlier. Well, I'd just tell you another very brief story, and it will be brief. So my way of illustrating this when I teach medical students is to say to them, look, I'm an elderly white male, a bit overweight, so there's a sporting chance I'll have a heart attack during this lecture. If I do, I want you to get me to the hospital and to its primary care unit as fast as you can. I don't want you to talk to me or ask me any questions. I want you to get me the best clotbuster according to the latest best evidence quickly and sort me out that way. And if I survive, I might well come and see you as a doctor 6 months later, not feeling very well. And you'll find then that your medicine and your evidence can offer you absolutely nothing that will help me, but you can.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting that, the integration. I had a patient once come to me with back pain, and I asked her what she thought was going on. And she goes, well, I've been told I have a kidney infection. So I said, well, I want you to take the antibiotic that your doctor recommended, and then we will work on replenishing all of the good microbiome and bacteria that the antibiotics are going to destroy. And she goes, well, I want to take medicine. And I go, well, our first step is that you live. I can treat you later for any chronic or imbalances. So first you got to stay alive. Then we'll do the other thing. So please go get the antibiotic, because 100 years ago, you died, right? Now that we have Western medicine, you could live and then see me afterwards. So I think we're aligned with that as well. There's a place for both, right? That's the inspiration. There's sometimes where you need a mechanic.
Yeah.
And then there's sometimes you need the gardener, right? And
yeah.
So like you said, don't throw the baby without the bathwater. Just call it medicine rather than you're practicing this way or that way. It's just, you know, and you know what? Different strokes for different folks. I find that the way I practice, it does require an effort. As in, you got to move your body, got to go to bed at night. Like, nothing I can do can override staying up to 4 in the morning, excessive alcohol, drug use, abusive relationships. Like, you do have to have some foundation pillars. I don't think there's too many pills in conventional medicine that overrides that, but it can keep you alive, even though you're suffering, I guess. Whereas, so integration is the message here. I appreciate that. You said you're in your 70s. I don't know. Are you on Facebook, Instagram? Is there a way? How do people connect with you?
So I don't use social media at all, because I think it's evil and a force for evil in the world. So I don't use social media. I do have an email address, which I'm happy to share with you now, if that's appropriate.
Yeah, if you're okay, people emailing you, and we'll put it in the show notes too, if you're okay.
Yes, I'm happy with that.
All right, let's hear your email.
It's p.diepp, that's D-I-E-P-P-E, at Exeter, Exeter.ac.uk.
Thank you. We'll put that in the show notes. And your book is, for our listeners, Healing in Medicine, A Doctor's Journey Toward Their Integration. Paul, thank you very much. I really enjoyed our conversation today.
Me too. Thank you, Lon. Thank you.
If you're looking for support to grow your family, contact AccuBalance Wellness Center. At AccuBalance, they help you reach your peak fertility potential through their integrative approach, using low-level laser therapy, fertility acupuncture, and naturopathic medicine. Download the AccuBalance Fertility Diet and Dr. Brown's video for mastering manifestation and clearing subconscious blocks. Go to AccuBalance.ca, that's A-C-U-Balance.ca.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Conscious Fertility, the show that helps you receive life on purpose. Please take a moment to subscribe to the show and join the community of women and men on their path to peak fertility and choosing to live consciously on purpose. I would love to continue this conversation with you, so please direct message me on Instagram at Lauren Brown Official. That's Instagram, Lauren Brown Official. Or you can visit my websites, laurenbrown.com and accubalance.ca. Until the next episode, stay curious, and for a few moments, bring your awareness to your heart center and breathe.